This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The city of Valparaiso, the officials and staff would like to know more about the housing market in the city for the benefit of all of the residents. And they in turn have commissioned a very important study. And in turn, let's find out more about the results of that study. We have with us Beth Schrader, who is the Valparaiso City Planning and Transit Director. And Beth, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, first, if you will tell us a little bit about the organization that has crunched all the data and where all the data came from. What did Urban Partners have to do to be able to come up with the study that you now have in your hands?
Well, Urban Partners is based out of Philadelphia. They're a small planning organization who specializes in doing these types of studies. Mm-hmm. So what they did for us is take a lot of the publicly available data. It's from Department of Housing and Urban Development, from Census, from American Community Survey, and then they're able to kind of crunch the numbers in a way that gives a snapshot of our housing market.
What were you and Mayor Murphy and other staffers at City Hall hoping to be able to put together from all of this data that's out there? A lot of it's out there. What were you hoping that you would receive, and in turn, some of the interesting findings that are in the study that the folks at the Urban Partners have put together?
We're hoping to just get a better handle on how we were doing as a community in terms of providing the type of housing and if it was best serving Valparaiso and it was fulfilling our mission and our comprehensive plan. So it was important to have kind of the baseline data. The last time that any of this was pulled, and it wasn't pulled in such a comprehensive way, was probably our comprehensive plan, which was adopted in 2013. Mm-hmm. So this serves as an update, we get a kind of a benchmark or a starting point going forward to see how we're doing. So I guess a number of the findings, some are surprising, some weren't necessarily. So there's a lot about Valparaiso that follows national trends. So on one level, that isn't terribly surprising that we are, like the rest of the nation, going to feel the effects of the silver tsunami, as our consultants like to call it.
So, oh, really?
The nation is aging, and the population of Valparaiso is aging too. So we have a large sector of our population that is moving into a phase of their life where they're looking for less maintenance, possibly smaller living quarters. They're looking, though, for amenities and walkability, too. So trying to provide housing types that satisfy those needs is important. And the great thing about that is those qualities are also attractive to other age groups, especially those who are just starting out. That was a good finding that came out of this, and I think provides us some direction of what we want to see. We also learned that in terms of our housing stock, we have kind of an aging housing stock, and that is not that's just something that we need to keep on top of, make sure that we're making investments into our existing housing stock so that we don't see any slippage of the quality and the property values. So that was an important finding. We also learned that we're facing affordability challenges, uh-huh, similar to the rest of the nation. So this is something that we did a pretty deep dive on, and we found that, you know, in terms of the county, the city of Valparaiso is kind of over-providing on some levels, but at the same time, we still have an affordability gap for many individuals that are in Valparaiso. So there's a lot of the strategies that came out of the data address multiple of these key findings at once. So there was encouragement of density and really capitalizing on the success of our downtown. That's kind of where we're seeing a lot of market pressure, but and we want to kind of allow that to happen. So we need to kind of assess the zoning around our downtown, our parking minimums, things that may be a stumbling block for developing that higher density around our downtown. And allowing that, making it easier, kind of helps address a number of things. So it helps with affordability. It helps with providing the type of housing that is that we need the most. More dense, walkable, access to amenities, low maintenance, and can also be affordable. So I think that was a big takeaway for us. And so our next steps are to really dive into the what types of changes we need to make to our code in order to allow that density to happen. So well, I'm excited about
sounds like you that. Got a lot to work on, to be sure. It's
absolutely.
a lot's come up in the last 7 years. Did in going through all of this with Urban Partners, did you find any real surprising things that go back 7 years that were not necessarily the case then, but they are now?
Well, the look back period is so depending on the data set. Urban Partners had data from 2010, which was, of course, the last census.
Yeah.
Some of the other data sets update at different intervals. So we're looking at 2016 for some of the HUD data. So there's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison between the data that was collected in 2013 as part of the master plan. I don't say that there was any huge surprises in the data based on what we knew in 2013. But I think that just having a more complete picture, and there was lots of interesting, even data points that seemed contradictory,
uh-huh.
But together they provide a more complete picture of our housing market.
I see. What kind of role does Valparaiso University play in putting the data together and certainly what was found the consultant came across when they put the report out to the city of Valparaiso?
Yeah, well, I think that, we're part of what makes Valparaiso Valparaiso is being a university town. So
right.
VU is very important to the community and to Valparaiso City, and I think it affects the development of our housing and the patterns that we see. So we're a lot more similar in our rates of rental housing to other university cities than we are to peer communities in the region. So we have a higher percentage of rentals in Valparaiso than you would see in, Crown Point or LaPorte, Portage, some of the other places around here. And so that is still the case. We do know that there's some decrease in enrollment at the university, and it's a little early to see all the effects of that in the data because of the dates that it was collected, but we seem to see a softening, especially around the university in terms of rental demand, even though 60% of the students are living off campus.
Oh.
At least the data that was collected still showed that. So I think that's going to be definitely a data set that we'll want to track and update going into the future to make sure that we're making decisions with all the right information.
Now, it looks like, based on what you've mentioned so far, Beth, that there's going to be a very serious study about the the housing areas that are around immediate downtown Valparaiso. Are we seeing that there are more people that want to live closer to downtown? That maybe
Absolutely.
they may have jobs outside of Porter mm-hmm. County, but they want to live close to downtown because they like all the amenities that they get to,
Absolutely.
To have.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything in particular that the consultants mentioned that they liked or mentioned about downtown that the city should know about to be able to better prepare for making changes that'll mean more housing and better housing for around downtown?
Well, I think the challenges that are specific to Valparaiso with increased density is just the way that a development would move through the process with the city. Do they have to get variances or try to change their zone in order to build the denser type of structures? We need to look at that and try to make it so that there's not extra steps in the process to build the type of denser housing that is appropriate around the downtown. But in order to do that, we have to have a good idea about the impact that will have on the neighborhoods and in terms of, demand on services, but also parking. That's always a big one that comes up. And so we need to update our parking analysis. So the last time that was done is 2010, and we have seen growth in the downtown since then. And
right.
and new developments come in. Denser developments near downtown. So we want to look at the parking counts, see if there's any room to, reduce those to make the density easier to build kind of by right without many extra steps mm-hmm. in the process.
It sounds like that the Valparaiso City Council and other city departments, including yours, are going to have a lot of work ahead. Some of the city council members have had a chance to take a look at some of the early data. Have something to say about it?
Absolutely. So we provided that to them, I think, before it went out to the public. And we had, I think, near all of our city council members join the presentation, the question and answer session that we had last Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some really good questions. And rightly so, they're all very interested in, okay, what are the next steps? What do we take from this data? How do we implement these strategies? And a lot of that will fall to my plate, but all of it will, kind of starts with my department, will go through the plan commission, and then it comes to city council. So there'll be a lot of time for consideration and really deliberating on these, important issues, make sure that we get it right.
Well, it sounds like, too, that the citizens of Valparaiso, once they get a chance to take a look at it, they'll be able to ask questions and in turn keep you all busy trying to answer their questions, too.
Yes, well, that's what we're here for, so I encourage everyone to, call the planning department with your questions or send me an email, and I'll be happy to walk you through it and answer any questions that you have.
Well, Beth, thank you for spending time going through the information that you have from this very, very comprehensive residential market analysis, the study that the consultants had put together for you and other members of city administration and the public in Valparaiso to take a look at. And we're all looking forward to more discussions in the near future about this and trying to find ways to make housing better in Valparaiso. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Beth Schrader is the Valparaiso City Planning and Transit Director, talking about the new residential market analysis that's just come out, and you can take a look at it on the City of Valparaiso website. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Indiana State Police have a scam warning out to everybody. It's mainly in Northeast Indiana, but could be anywhere in the Hoosier State, including here in Northwest Indiana. It's all about a child safety kit, Facebook scam. And with us to talk about it, we have the public information officer for the Indiana State Police Fort Wayne District with us, Sergeant Brian Walker. And Sergeant Walker, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a really important topic, and I'm glad you're going to give us a little bit of time to talk about it.
Well, it's very possible that there may have gotten some scammers here in our corner of the state. It's not focused simply on the Fort Wayne area, and I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out to be a statewide scam or two. But if you will, fill us in on some of the early problems that have come up with callers reporting in eventually to the state police about these people and this child safety kit scam.
So first of all, as the warning goes, we have not seen yet, we have not had any reported issues that have risen to a criminal investigation at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The basis for this warning is that this is a scam, it seems to be a scam, perpetuated on Facebook through a direct link to wherein the consumer provides personal information, name, address, and phone number. From that information, which you voluntarily have given, they're receiving a follow-up phone call to arrange an in-home personal meeting to provide this child safety kit service.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens then, you have voluntarily invited somebody to come to your house, not knowing this person and not knowing what their true intentions are, and they could be nefarious. We just don't always know that. The four reported cases this week that we've had in the Fort Wayne area, the persons that show up at your house will be well-dressed. And again, they're trying to entice you into your confidence and your trust by presenting themselves well, and getting you to invite them into their home. Another red flag. And you do not invite strangers into your home. Two things associated with the scam will happen. So first, they're offering to place an app on your phone. An app, the Child Safety Kit app, contains information that you put in there regarding your child's identification, their medical history, all the personal information that you do not need to put into an app on your phone. You already have, as a parent, you have that information.
Right.
Why do we give that to somebody else or put it into an app on our phone? This app, whether it's legit or not, we have not verified, but that app could be evasive. That app could very well attach itself to your other apps on your phone, your personal information, and give that access to these persons then, which you really don't know who these persons really are at this point. And then what we've also had is the offering of an insurance policy for your child. And we actually have had a couple instances where the consumers have purchased an insurance policy and given bank account information to do automatic withdrawals to pay for this insurance policy. Is that insurance policy legitimate? We don't know. And you've now given them financial information on top of all the personal information that you put into this insurance policy application. You've voluntarily done this. And is the policy legit? If you want an insurance policy for your child, you go through your employer, go through your insurance agent for your home, your auto, somebody that you already know and have an established relationship with. You shouldn't just give this information to someone that shows up at your door. So there's all kinds of red flags involved in this scam.
Also, too, I understand, Sergeant Walker, that at some point, at least that's one of the reports I understand, is that somebody who's mentioned it to the state police had said that the caller was, besides being very, very, very persistent and wanting to set up this personal appointment, they also falsely claimed that they're working with the state police.
Exactly. So another red flag. Again, they're trying to establish trust and confidence by telling you they're associated with a law enforcement agency. That gives you comfort in knowing or thinking that you can trust this person. The Indiana State Police is not associated with any such child safety kit offering. And as far as I know, none of the local law enforcement agencies here in Fort Wayne are involved either. So mm-hmm. It could be any law enforcement agency that they say that they're with. That's another red flag just to gain your trust and confidence.
Now, how long, as far as you know, and your colleagues at the state police know, has this scam been going on?
So we documented this back to 2019 in a news story that was put out by a Louisville media outlet.
Uh-huh.
talking about an Evansville woman that had reported this. And so we know as far back as 2019, since we've put this news release out, we've gotten four actual incidents here in Fort Wayne that people have called in and reported this activity at their house. The good thing is that two of the callers did not allow these persons to enter their home. They didn't feel comfortable, and they rejected their entry into the home, and that was good. The other two have allowed them into their home. Now, we know that from previous criminal incidents where we've had people that want to come in and sell you something, a lot of times they're coming in to just case your house for a future burglary or break-in. We have not had that happen yet in the four that we've just received calls on. But how long does that take? Maybe it'll be 6 months from now. Maybe it'll be a year from now when they come back and they, they do harm to your, you break into your house or whatever it may be.
Well, you think too, on top of all of this, we are also still in a coronavirus pandemic. So it's not wise to let anybody into your home, especially somebody even if they offer some kind of offer to you, something that they think that if they can get away with it, it'd be some kind of a benefit to you. You don't want extra people in the house that you don't know, nobody in your bubble, so to speak. I'm sure none of these scammers are in any of these people's bubbles, so it's not safe health-wise to even be close to these people.
That is a good point. And we can't say that any of this is associated with the pandemic or that heightened awareness or, the people's concerns have been generated for their child's safety based on the pandemic. This is just one of those things where we have parents that want to be good parents and do the right things to protect their children. And they find this on Facebook and they think, this is something that I should do as a good parent. But we're here to tell you that as a good parent, you've already got the information that you need in case your child were to come missing or to be abducted. You have photos of your child, all of your child's personal information, your doctor's information for the child, dental records. You already have all of that. And that would be provided to that law enforcement agency should something like that take place. You don't need to put it on an app on your phone. You definitely don't need to give it any of that information to a stranger.
I know in the past, working with the Indiana State Police and other districts around the Hoosier State, they've offered up times to help be with people in better physical times or health-wise times to help with pass along child safety kits or information. They do it on your own, and the Indiana State Police cooperate, and they set this up directly. And this obviously is not one of these state police-endorsed child safety kit items, to be sure. Now, if anybody happens to get wind of this, certainly, but if they happen, unfortunately, you have to receive any of these calls, what do they need to do?
Well, the first thing you need to do, if you provided personal information, especially financial information, your social security number, names and dates of birth to strangers associated with this, the first thing you need to do is check your credit agencies, make sure that your accounts have not been compromised, check with your financial institutions, your credit cards, your banks, and make sure that initially none of this financial information has been compromised in any way. Again, that's not to say that you might not find a compromise later on down the road. If you're unsure, if you're uncomfortable and you feel like you've been defrauded or you've been scammed, then the best thing to do would be to contact those respective financial institutions and have those accounts either locked, closed, have a new account established to protect yourself. It's just risky to give that information out in the first place. And who knows how long it's going to take before you are compromised.
It's wise to contact the Indiana State Police Post and where you live, and particularly here in Northwest Indiana, it would be the post in Lowell, or maybe if you live up in North Central Indiana, maybe the state toll road post up there in Bremen, in that area. So there are places to contact law enforcement to be sure and let them know about it too, I would imagine.
Exactly. Contact your local police agency or contact your nearest state police post. And we would be more than happy to take your call and try and help you figure out what your situation may or may not be.
Well, Sergeant Walker, thank you very much for spending time going over what this child safety kit Facebook scam is all about. And we hope that we can do our part to help prevent more people from certainly being intruded upon by these callers, and better still, that they don't happen to be falling prey to this scam, to be sure. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Where were you, or what were you doing on March 16th? That was the date that the pandemic was hitting America hard. And as a result, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 3,000 points that day, made it the largest single-day market drop in history and the worst turn of the Dow since the 1987 recession. Well, should we be ready for another significant drop? Let's find out. We're talking with Northwest Indiana Greg Hammer about it today. And Greg, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, what should we probably do if it's worth checking into about our investments and our risk tolerance to make sure that we are able to get caught up just in case the market goes balloony again?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, you know, reevaluate your risk tolerance. If there was a situation last year where you made decisions based on, for lack of a better word, a panic or discomfort, so to speak, with the market volatility, the first thing is just to make sure that, you know, your ability to endure those types of volatility in the market makes sense for your risk tolerance. And it's important because you don't want to make the mistake, right? Rule 101, don't take money out when the market's down.
And we probably should have learned that lesson, if not before the pandemic even hit, right?
Yeah, and I think the big danger is people freak out, right? They feel like the market's going to, you know, head to a different direction. I mean, the reality of it is we've had a very strong market for the last decade, really, when you think about it. And, you know, investing without considering your risk tolerance, I mean, everybody has a high risk tolerance when the market's doing well. It's when we start seeing the volatility that we really maybe come to terms a little bit more with what our risk tolerance really is. And having an understanding of that risk tolerance, you know, could work both ways, too, because if you're playing it too conservative, are you going to be able to get enough results from your investments to reach your goals?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of really getting a good comfort level and understanding that, you know, longer the time horizon, the more predictable the outcomes.
What seems to be the biggest danger as you assess risk tolerance? What are the biggest dangers that we should know about and try not to get ourselves into?
Yeah, I think the biggest danger is, you know, people are not, I mean, they just freak out, right? It's just a matter of panic. We see things going down, especially as you're, you know, you're near retirement or really when you've worked hard to accumulate a lot of money. I think when we start to see it go the wrong direction on bigger amounts of money, the impact becomes more real, right? If we have a small dollars in our 401k, we're just getting started, you know, a big percentage drop is not a lot of dollar value. But as we've accumulated money, we've worked hard and put quite substantial assets in those retirement vehicles, even a smaller percentage becomes more real because of the larger dollar amount associated mm-hmm. with it.
Now, what should investors do? What should they ask themselves, I suppose, looking at it that way, so they can get a better understanding of what their risk tolerance really is?
Well, and I think there's really three key components to look at. I mean, the first one, you know, your timeline. What is your investment timeline? How old are you? How close are you to being retired? And understanding that, you know, the phase of your life, what phase you're in, plays a huge role in understanding your risk tolerance. If we're in the accumulation phase, as we call it, you know, there's still dollar cost averaging. Usually, you know, you're willing to tolerate a little bit more volatility as you're contributing. You know, there's advantage to that volatility in buying more shares. And, you know, you likely don't want the investments, you know, to be, your timeline just warrants more volatility comfort level. And then I think that the second thing is, you know, what are your objectives? You know, they play a key role. If you're looking, you know, for kids' college education versus retirement, might dictate, you know, the type of volatility you're willing to accept in that because of not only time horizons, but, you know, hey, I've gotten money put aside for education, don't want to lose it. Retirement, there's a different start point. I can retire maybe 1 year, maybe delay a year, 2 years, but college is definitely going to be the year my kid graduates from high school. And then finally, experience has mm-hmm. a lot to do with it. You know, what comfort level do you have with investments? Are you a new investor? Are you an experienced investor? Are you used to the volatility? Do you have a pretty good understanding of, you know, how that volatility impacts overall returns, how the asset balance are affected, and so forth?
Okay, if you have a better understanding of what your risk tolerance may happen to be, what's the next step or steps you need to take?
Well, I think the biggest thing is creating an income plan for yourself, a distribution plan, understanding, what your objectives are, what your risk is. It's going to take a lot of the emotion out of the equation, and that's usually what impacts people the most. The emotion, we make decisions based on our emotion more so than logic sometimes. So I think it's important just to, you have somebody that you can consult with. If you have a professional that you're working with to adjust your portfolio, kind of talk you off the ledge, so to speak, give you a little bit better idea of what to expect with the market and understand that, there is going to be volatility and here's how we're going to address it in our plan. And, staying focused on the big objective, the big picture, and on your future will help, eliminate a lot of those spur-of-the-moment decisions.
Well, looking back to March 16th of last year, can you think of any of your clients that either caught themselves unaware or they were better prepared so they weren't affected by the drop?
Well, and, it's funny you say it, Chris, because I don't think anybody's really prepared for a 30% drop in a very, very short period of time. But, again, what we had in place was a plan. We know that the market's going to correct. It has historically, and it will again in the future. And, things are going to go up and things are going to go down. But considering and understanding what your time horizon is, like we've talked about, what your risk tolerance is, and, one of the questions we ask people, if you want to make, X amount, are you willing to lose Y amount? And, it gives them a little bit better understanding that you're going to see that volatility. And somebody who was invested for a long time horizon, even though that drop existed, by reallocating properly, making sure that you stay allocated to your risk, because that's probably one of the things that is a common mistake. Equities tend to grow faster, so people's balance gets out of relationship with what their risk tolerance is, and then they see a bigger impact. So just make sure you continue to reallocate, understand that what the purpose of those assets are, when they're going to be used, and be willing to make sure you don't let emotions trip you up.
Well, Greg, thank you for spending time looking at this very important anniversary that we're coming up on March 16th. And let's trust that the Dow Jones Industrial Average doesn't make another big drop on the first anniversary, to be sure. And that doesn't happen again, at least not anytime soon. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thanks, Chris.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Governor Eric Holcomb and the Indiana Department of Natural Resources have announced the next round of Next Level Trails Program grants, and some of those are coming to Northwest Indiana. Let's find out more. With us to talk about it is Mitch Barloga. He's a transportation planner for the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission. Mitch, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here.
Well, it's good to hear that we're going to get some of the nearly $30 million that's going to go out across the Hoosier State for some of our trails and other projects here. I'll turn things over to you. Fill us in on which of the projects of the 17 announced around Indiana are going to be coming to Northwest Indiana this time around.
Yes, Chris. We're very excited. Three projects were funded by Governor Holcomb with the help of the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. They include the completion of the Pensy Greenway to Crown Point and the continuation of the trail through the city to the southeast, connecting to the Veterans Memorial Trail. That'll pick up at US 231 and run to Hebron. So that's just about 2.5 miles that was awarded for just under $3 million. The city of Portage was awarded a significant link in the Marquette Greenway Network. The Marquette Greenway is a three-state initiative from Chicago to New Buffalo. It's just under a mile in length, but it includes a bridge over Salt Creek, and they received $2.5 million. And finally, the city of Valparaiso, they received a smaller project. There's a couple of categories for Next Level Trails, regional and local. They received a local project, the extension of Vail Park Trail, along their roadway, and that was just over $360,000. So combined, you have just about 5 miles of new trail planned here in Northwest Indiana.
I know you keep close tabs of the ones that are getting extra funding and the ones that are under construction or planned for construction all across the region. as part of your work with the organization, but especially important to see that the Veterans Memorial Trail here in Lake County is certainly getting a little bit more help than usual, because it does continue on something that of course that is very important to not only to residents but to veterans here in the region.
Well, certainly. The Veterans Trail is kind of a multi-dimensional project in the sense that there is a trail there, and that extends from Crown Point to Hebron along U.S. 231, where the old Pennsylvania Railroad used to run parallel to. But there's a series of memorials being developed as well. I'm part of that organization that's helping to get that done. We have a Korean memorial near Leroy, and we have two new memorials that we're developing, the World War I, II, and Holocaust in Crown Point, and the Mideast Memorial in Hebron.
Do some of these trails, especially the ones here in Northwest Indiana, get the benefit of not only showing people off what some of the ways that you can get some exercise are here in Northwest Indiana, but also a chance to enjoy the beauty of our neighborhoods?
Well, certainly. It offers people the opportunity to kind of go off the grid. We're all familiar with living around roadways. We've been doing that our whole life. We're all connected to the cars. The trails break away from that. They usually run along abandoned rail lines or even NIPSCO or utility corridors, riparian riverways, and we're not familiar with those areas as much. And so people have a whole new perspective on their region, and when they ride around our trails, there's a tremendous amount of beauty, nature, and appreciation, and people really have a greater sense of the place that they live and a much better respect for it.
Are we finding that since we're still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, that it's maybe for many people the only opportunity they get some real exercise because they can get to be outdoors?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true, Chris. Those numbers over the last year have been exponentially high for trails in this region, in the state, and throughout the country. It's been kind of an explosion of new interest that people are taking and getting out on trails. And we've seen our numbers double here in the region alone on our major trail corridors. And bicycle retail, people will tell you straight up, it's been a very difficult, I mean in a good way for them, a very difficult year keeping stock in their stores. The bicycles have been selling off the racks. They can't even repair bicycles because of the supply chain is more or less broken down.
Yeah,
I think that has repaired itself over the last few months, but that's what we saw during the height of the epidemic.
Are we finding that some of these trails, even though some are already completed to a point and they want to be expanded, are some of these projects that are getting this share of the next level, the trails funding from the state, are they going to be able to help either create new sections or at least to finish them off?
Well, certainly. The two trails that were identified, again, the two regional trails, the one in Crown Point, as I mentioned before, Chris, this is the finishing of the Pensy Greenway.
Yeah.
That is a trail that goes from Crown Point and then crosses the state line up into Cal City, Illinois. And then it's part of a much larger network called the Great American Rail Trail. This is a national trail vision that goes from Washington, D.C. to Seattle, Washington. And this is a major component of that network. And then the segment of Portage is part of our Marquette Greenway, a three-state initiative, and that's gaining a lot of momentum as well. Just last year, we had probably over 6 miles of the Marquette Greenway built in Michigan City and Burns Harbor. And this project here that has just been awarded will connect the Burns Harbor segment into the city of Portage.
Now, for folks that are not familiar with the process involving NERPC, what do they get to do in working with the communities and the organizers and keeping the trails on schedule, so to speak, either the continued work or finishing work, whichever it may be, especially when it comes to being able to apply for this state funding? What does NERPC get to do in turning in the applications?
Well, we like to say that we advise and inspire. We have no regulatory authority over our communities, but we do provide quite a bit of federal funding if they choose to participate. And much of our federal funding does go towards trail development. And so we work with them on proposed projects and finding out what the best projects are. Of course, we plan. That's in our name, planning. So
right.
We've been planning for the trails here in Northwest Indiana real specifically for over 20 years now. And because of that planning process, we've been able to tease out some of these better regional corridors. And because of that, we've been able to connect the dots a lot better. And they come to us. We work with them on the planning. We also are able to identify and prepare projects for statewide or other funding opportunities, such as Next Level Trails. And that's why we have seen so much great success in receiving this money over the years.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mitch, if you will, tell us, if you know, on some of these projects where there's more work to be done, when do those work projects get to be started now? Are they going to go in just as soon as we get the break in the weather, which we're starting to get now?
Like any outside construction project, asphalt companies, they all shut down during the wintertime, so now they'll start resuming. The projects that you see here that were just selected, the great part about it, not only getting the money, which is fantastic, but it's the fact where it's coming from. People usually don't realize the difference between federal and state and local monies. State and federal monies are very different in what is required of them and the hoops you have to jump through. Usually federal projects can cost, you know, a third more, if not double, than what you would get with local money. And not only that, you can build with local money almost 3 to 4 times faster than you can build with federal money. And a case in point, Hebron received some of this money last year during the first round of Next Level Trails, and I'm talking about last year, 2019.
Right.
But back in 2020, they opened that trail, that 1 mile of the Veterans Trail in Hebron opened within a year of being funded. So I am expecting that all three of these projects could be open within the next 2 years just because of how fast state money can be used.
That's great to hear. Mitch Barloga is the transportation planner for the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission. He keeps a close eye on trails and the like here in Northwest Indiana within NERPC. And we've just found out now the next round in the Next Level Trails funding's come out of Indianapolis, and that Lake County and Porter County are getting a share of that for the projects there. Mitch, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll be with us tomorrow.